this week, our guest is a teacher and a coach from the States. He lives just outside of New York and is here to tell us about his spectacular recovery from clinical depression and his continued challenges that keep him well. It's really nice to meet you. Thank you for your time. What time is it where you are then?
9 o'clock in the morning.
9 o'clock in the morning in New York. We are very lucky to have you. So Kenny's told me a little bit about what you've done, but I do try and stay kind of, I want our listeners to get the first-hand information about what you've achieved and why you feel it's important to share with other people who may or may not be looking for some sort of relief or some sort of solution to an issue with mental health or well-being, or just to those really who find what your story inspiring. So just from the beginning, tell me what brought you into this kind of field.
First of all, thank you for having me on, Amber.
You're so welcome.
Secondly, really, the story begins about 20 years ago, February. If we were 2 months ago, it would be 20 years ago, exactly. So what happened was at that point in time, I had started to exhibit what is now known as the symptoms of clinical depression, but I didn't know how I felt, how to name. And what I mean by that was there's no history of depression that I'm aware of in my family. So it wasn't something that we... All of a sudden, you couldn't monitor something that you didn't know existed, maybe on my parents' part or what have you. But that being said, so for about 100 days, I felt pretty much all the symptoms, just very fatigued, very tired. I didn't want to do anything at all. I wanted to lay in bed all day. I wanted to basically, when we would get to the just going through the day, for example, every second felt a minute, every minute felt an hour, every hour felt a day. It just drear and just, you know, extended. I just wanted to go to sleep. And honestly, I didn't want to wake up. That's, you know, just thoughts of suicide. I was easily triggered. I would want to cry for no reason, absolutely no reason. And I had a friend who, after some time, he said to me, Jim, are you okay? And I said, honestly, no, I'm not. There's something wrong. I don't know what it is, but it was scary because I lived in my own head for about 100 days, Amber, and it was very incredibly scary. I knew I needed to do something. I just didn't know what I needed to do. And I mean, I'm Catholic and I prayed every single day. And I mean, my entire day, the reason I think I'm still here today is just because of my prayer life. I just clung on. I even told God, I said, either please help me better, or take me. I'm not going to do it myself, but I don't care what you choose. Just one or the
just
other.
Just choose.
I don't care which one it is because I can't live this anymore. And what happened was eventually then my friend had talked to me and then I wound up looking up the symptoms of depression, clinical depression. And I had the whole world on my shoulder, a weight of the world on my shoulders. And I'm looking at some of the symptoms and I had every single one, Amber. And I don't know if I had been so excited in my entire life, or at least within those 100 days, because it was, oh my gosh. And I was so taken aback by it that I almost didn't believe the first website. So I must have looked at 5, 6, 7 different websites for the symptoms. No, all of them were the same.
Yeah.
So I wound up printing out the symptoms from a couple of the websites. I made an appointment with my primary care physician. I was embarrassed because I didn't know, how are people going to look at me? I don't want to go into the office and in that doctor's office and be, I've been in hundreds of times before, but it was the stigma of mental health. I think that caused that. And she was also one of the doctors at the local university where I actually happened to go as well.
Okay.
So I emailed her because I was youth leader at that point at my church. And I emailed her and I said, Dr. Vellani, I would like to meet with you. I think I have clinical depression, but is it okay if we meet over at the university? And she was, yeah, no problem. Well, let's set an appointment. I'll come see you. And she was wonderful, amazing doctor, phenomenal doctor. And
big difference, you know, when you finally do go to help.
Yes. Oh, it was, I felt phenomenal. And I diagnosed myself pretty much. I said, Dr. Vellani, I'm 99.9% sure I have clinical depression. Here, I have every single symptom there is here. But I need you to help. I need you to diagnose me. And she gave me a depression screening test. And she's, yes, you do have it, Jim. And then we made a plan, basically a plan of attack for how to approach it. because I was scared. And I should say this too, Amber, because I think it's important to be said, is I remember going in and telling her I was nervous, embarrassed, scared. And she said, Jim, I want you to know something. You are not the first person I have ever diagnosed with clinical depression, and you most certainly will not be the last. Yeah. So that in itself, I think it's just important to be said that it's not rare. I've read different research that says 25 to 26, 27% of people around the world will be diagnosed with some sort of mental health challenge in their lifetime. Yeah. In a nuclear family of four, that's one. So really, every family could be affected by this. But that's the gist of it, Amber. And then obviously we made a plan. I went to talk therapy for about 3 or 4 months, weekly, biweekly, eventually. And I did take an antidepressant because it was something that was needed.
I was going to speak to you about that because that seems to be like the approach that your doctor had. She was obviously a very good doctor. Presumably she'd either been through something like herself or had enough experience of it to treat it with the seriousness it deserved. But I think particularly in this country over the last 20 years, it's different now. I know the last 5, 6 years we have made leaps and bounds, but it was very much a case of, right, well, I'll tell you how we can fix this. We can put you on medication and that will rebalance the brain. The chemicals that are causing the depression will no longer be as strong, blah, blah, blah. But it doesn't formulate a plan. There's no way out of that.
If you go to therapy, that is part of the entire process of getting better, in my strong opinion, because the medicine will only do so much. A friend, that's different. They know you at a different level. Going to a professional who, a talk therapist is who I went to, I believe she was a registered nurse who had that degree, whatever, also something with that. And she was wonderful. I mean, wonderful. It wasn't she tried to, per se, fix me, just to get things off my chest that maybe had, I didn't realize we're there per se. Maybe it was a mountain out of a molehill. Pardon me.
I think it's that repression of feelings as well, isn't it? And issues and problems. And I always used to describe it as carrying a mattress on my head. It was, I can carry one mattress, but then when the next one comes on, that's even harder to bear.
Yeah.
And my struggle was my depression. And it got to the point where there were so many mattresses on there, I just couldn't stand anymore. I was just flattened. And that's when I'd hit my lowest point.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm just sick of this. But again, with therapists, you see, I was very lucky too. But people don't have to stay with a therapist that they don't click with. That's really important, isn't it?
Oh, very important. I was very blessed that the medicine I was prescribed and the therapist that I went to, I did click with immediately. And I know not everyone has that initial success, because my friend who actually had told me, Jim, I think you are going through depression, I took Paxil. Now, that was just what was prescribed to me. I took it. It helped wonderfully. My same friend took Paxil, and it made him worse. He's like, I can't take it. So you really need to be cognizant, be aware of how you're feeling, especially those first couple weeks while the medicine gets into your bloodstream, because in some cases, it can make you feel worse. In my case, I was fortunate it didn't. But at the same time, you said with the therapist, I do know some people say, well, I went to therapy, it didn't work. Well, try another therapist. Yeah. You're not with the right therapist. You need to maybe try another therapist then. I'd call it a silo, where maybe you need to look outside of that silo. Maybe this is what was prescribed to you to go to this therapist, or maybe you chose this one initially. It doesn't always work out. It's almost if you're dating someone, maybe it doesn't work out with this person. You go to someone else. You're looking for that right person that you gel with.
We've just been speaking to a relationship and dating expert, and it was exactly about that. And unfortunately, once you've been through a toxic relationship, your programming then does kind of become, right, well, I'm not going to have anyone in my life then, despite the fact that you're actually hiding, really, that inherent human need to be loved. But actually, people are the same with therapy. It's once stung. Well, I'm not going to set myself up for that again. But therapy really can work. I mean, I was very skeptical about it. I was terrified of what was in my head that I'd never shared with anybody.
No. Yeah, I'm the same way. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, and yet somehow, because of the trust and her professionalism and expertise, she managed to coax it in a way that I could cope with, rather than opening the tin of worms sort of thing, you know.
Oh, it It sounds very similar to my experience. I don't remember over what, but I remember crying in her office. I remember that after I did, it felt very liberating because it was almost a levee or a dam that had been broken. But once I said whatever it was, because again, this was 20 years ago, so I don't even know what it was, but it obviously bothered me enough to have that sort of emotion. So and this was a couple times I could recall over the 3-4 months that I saw her that I did it. But when I did, it was, wow, I feel a lot better. And that's why I think it's so important to see a, you know, proper therapist as opposed to just talking to a friend and venting to a friend. It's a different thing because the therapist has the proper training where they can help you and they can help guide you. And
when you've been diagnosed, you know, obviously that is, I mean, there are a lot of services out there, particularly that Tonic Health provide, which is to do with just accepting that you're going to have not so good days and connecting with other people. But if you're diagnosed with mental health illness, it is integral that you seek the right professional help, isn't it?
Because without a doubt.
That she literally saved my life, and I'm sure you feel the same with yours. And it's when I go to the physio, when I go to see Michael at Tonic Health, I go and see my physio, and I come out and I feel the weight's been lifted off my shoulders, because it's actually a shoulder problem I have, but it's actually a really good correlation between how I felt when I walked out of therapy. And I think the fear is that you'll go in there and you'll feel worse because you've opened up, because you've touched on things that you didn't. But their job is to go, okay, let's open just this little wound right now. Let's put the plaster back on it, and it'll be a little bit more healed the next time we take the plaster off. It's very clever what they do.
Oh, 100%. When you find the correct doctor and the correct therapist, they're angels. I mean, they really are, in my opinion. They're good people who, when they do their job correctly, when you find that correct, that one that really you mold with, you gel with, that you feel, wow, this person is really helping. I look forward to my therapy. The first time I remember, I was scared. I don't know if I want to do this. Why am I doing this? I went in and it was a good session and I was, okay, I'll come back next week. And I just kept feeling better and better. And there came a point where I actually looked forward to going back because I kept feeling better every week or biweekly or whatever. And then there came a point in time, maybe about 3 or 4 months, we kind of said, Jim, I think you're in a good spot. I remember her telling me. She said, I don't think you have to come back anymore. You're obviously welcome back anytime if you think you need it. If you have a relapse, do not think that my door is closed on you. I think you're in a good place. And I agreed with her because I was getting to that same point myself. But it was the therapy just helped me to get things off my chest that might be bothering me.
Yeah. Is that where your story sort of goes from there?
Well, from there it does, because part of it was also, and I have to bring my dog into it, he was a golden retriever named Sonny. I call him an angel in fur. He was wonderful. And when I was going through depression, I remember laying on the sofa at my parents' house. That's where I live. And he would come up to me and we had this understanding. He would just look at me, just nose about this far away. And I was like, you need me to take you for a walk, buddy. Don't you need me to take you for a walk? I need to take you for a walk, but I need you to put the leash on me. It was just this unique understanding that only he and I had. And we would go for a walk around the block, one block, two blocks before. And I felt good. I felt really good. And then before it, I said, I'm going to go for a mile and Sonny could come with me. And then, but it was just a walk. But then I started to really feel good. I said, I'm going to try to jog. So I went for a mile. And I mean, I would stop in between to walk. It was more of a walk run. And then I went for a 5K. And the endorphin rush was there. It was my own created drug that my body created. And I felt wonderful after that. And I said, you know, at that point in time, after doing the 5K, I said, and this is not the way to do it. I'm going to say what I'm about to tell you. It's do as I say, not as I do. Okay. I decided to go from a 5K to a 42K known as a marathon. So I skipped the 10K. I skipped the half marathon. I went right to training for a marathon. That is not how you do it. Please do not. No one out there who is listening or watching do it that way. But it was my way, I think, of telling my depression that I control you. You don't control me. So I would do these longer runs, walks, whatever. And then I did a first marathon at a Steamtown, which is in Scranton, Pennsylvania, which it's about an hour north of where I live. So I did that marathon. And I, of course, you have a lot of lactic acid. You're in pain for a couple of days afterwards. But mentally, I felt priceless I felt wonderful. Yeah. It was, this is great. And I remember being interviewed at a local TV station about doing the marathon. And I remember telling the person who interviewed me, I would rather do 100 consecutive marathons than have to go through depression again. Yeah. So that in itself really resonated with me at that time. And I said, well, I physically can't do 100 marathons in a row. I can't not just keep going, but I can do 100 in my lifetime and make that a target goal. So that's what I did. So to get back to 100 days, I suffered in silence. And I said, this is my way of symbolically getting back each day that I lost. Can I get the day back? No, I can't. But can I symbolically? Yes. Because when you begin a marathon, when you finish one, you're forever changed. You are no longer the same person you are when you started. It's just such a mental game as much as physical game. And I'm very slow. If you look at any of my races, if there's 15 or 16 pages worth of finishers, look at page 15 or 16, Amber. That's where you'll find my name. There's no way I'm going to qualify for the Boston Marathon with my times. I'm very slow. I toward the back, but I enjoy what I do. And I think my message, or the message, needs to be sent for people. In 2014, I did 3 marathons in 3 months. And in 2016, I did 4 marathons in 4 months, March, April, May, June. Yes. And that was before I started my doctoral studies, which was in September of that 2016. And I knew that I wasn't going to be able to do any marathons while I was doing them. Just, it's a very intense program at Drexel University in Philadelphia that I'm glad that I'm done with, because now I can do some of these other things, and I can look forward to training for another marathon. I've done 21 total. So right now that's where I am in that goal. And I mean, God bless my wife, who's followed me all over God's green earth, who's brought the 3 dogs with us all over to support me at different places throughout the marathons. I can't think of anyone else who is a more top marathon fan or supporter than she is.
Well, she's kind of had to be, but mm-hmm. I suppose she's supporting the message that you're trying to get across, mm-hmm. really, that lovely symbolic gesture that for each of those days that you are claiming that day back. And that phrase that you said, you would rather run 100 marathons than suffer with depression again. I totally with you on that. Do you feel that that puts it more in perspective for people that maybe haven't suffered with ill mental health before? Do you think even they can relate to it on that level?
I think to a certain degree, a lot of people, let's be honest, will not want to do one marathon. Only 1-2% of the population in the world has done one marathon. So to imagine doing 100, that has to say something. I would hope it does, because that's a lot to do, because it's tough now to relate to how I felt 20 years ago, because I'm in such a good spot where I am now. And to liken it to one of my British heroes, Winston Churchill, as he said, when you're going through hell, just keep going. And that's really how I felt. I said, I'm just going to keep going. And I was blessed to have people who took me by the hand and helped me get to the other side.
People say, oh, you're so strong. Well, yeah, but that was because of what I went through, mm-hmm. because of how difficult it is to get through depression and come out the other side still alive and happy, to then end up feeling that happy feeling. I mean, that's just nothing else on earth, isn't it?
I agree, because people will even tell me, you love to hear yourself laugh, don't you? Or they will just laugh at me laughing. And because of how much I enjoy being on this side of depression, I'll watch The Office. I love the American version. There'll be times I'll be on my sofa. I will fall over. And I mean, I'll be crying and my stomach hurts. And we have a television show here in the United States called The Impractical Jokers that I watch.
Oh, we've watched all of those. Oh, we have had them on Netflix Yeah.
I will tell you this now, and this is a true story, Amber. So if you do know I'm talking, James Murray called me. He called me because I had purchased his book. So the one day, this was in October. So he said, anyone who buys my book this day, I will call you. So I got to speak to him personally. And I told him how much I appreciate everything they do because of the necessary laughter they provide for the entire world, especially now with COVID and everything. And he I even told him, and they are mentioned in my acknowledgments, my dissertation by name. And I told them that, I said, you guys are fantastic. You're awesome. Everything you do, it's just so necessary because of the laughter on another side. Hmm. When I did work at my church, I speak Spanish. I'm a Spanish teacher. So I'm a fluent. So when we went, we've done some service trips to El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Mexico. Well, talking to the people in those countries and be able to really talk, not saying, hey, ask them this question. No, I'm talking to them. We're talking right now. Gave me a greater perspective on what is really important. I put things into what is a first world problem and what is a third world problem. For example, I coach women's soccer, football, what have you, at the school where I teach. Something happened in one of our drills, and the girls, no, that ball was out. No, it was in. I said, ladies, that's a first world problem. If that's the worst problem you have today, you have zero problems. But I talk to people in some of these countries. And an example I have to give, Amber, is an individual I met when I was in the process of getting my master's degree, and I met him, and he lived near Lake Nicaragua. His name was Juan. And I talked to him, and I just talked, he was same age. And I said, so do you go to school? Are you going to college? I'm ignorant to the whole thing at this point in time. And he said, no, I don't. I never went to school. So I said, what do you mean? Did you not go to high school? No, I didn't go to school. You didn't go to middle school. And he said, no, I never set foot in a classroom. And I said, what? This boggled my mind, Amber, because here's an individual who's the same age as me at that time, about 25. Here I am going for a master's degree, and he's never set foot in a classroom. And for me, that's a real problem.
Yeah.
The ball going out of bounds or not, that is not a problem.
For that dissertation or whatever, and you're tearing your hair out and you don't know how you're going to finish it, and the stress that you pile on yourself, and you're upset, and you can feel the, I need alcohol and blah, blah, blah. Well, yeah, you've got an education.
Yeah, and in fact, I will tell you this. I've actually mentioned the people that I've met, the organizations, Unbound is one that I met, and Food for the Poor was another that facilitated those trips. And the people I met in my acknowledgments, because of the fact that they provided opportunities for me to really see what the world is, but it gives me an opportunity. And now, almost an obligation, because with great power comes great responsibility. I mean, to do something about it. So that's kind of also given me a different perspective. And it did so with the depression. I would oftentimes tell myself, is this a life or death situation or is it not? Because if it's not, then I don't need to worry about it right now. It's not as important right now.
Well, I just think you are so inspirational. I mean, 21 marathons.
No, thank
you've
you.
I'm really bad at maths, but that's 79 to go. Let's hope you don't break a foot or anything and put yourself back.
No, I know that's my hope too. If anything, one thing that thank you for the compliment. It's just, I'm very humbled to be able to do what I do. It's something that, to go back to my trips, I have to give, you know, credit to someone that I learned about because he unfortunately passed away. As in El Salvador, there is a Monsignor there, Saint Monsignor Oscar Romero. He was the voice for the voiceless of the people of El Salvador. And I came to be fascinated by this individual because of he was so passionate about injustice and these people need help. You're not providing that. And he unfortunately was murdered for speaking out. Uh-huh. But I saw where he was killed, the actual church, and it just moved me. I saw the garment he was wearing with the bloodstain. I saw his apartment. I saw his tomb. It just moved me. But he was known as the voice for the voiceless, for the financially poor and destitute. Mm. And it kind of has inspired me to be a voice for the voiceless for those going through mental health challenges,
yes,
through anxiety. I'm not looking to be a hero by any means. It's just, this is my calling. I knew it. We're talking about the pets as well, rescue pets. I have to call myself or think of myself as a voice for the voiceless of rescue pets because they don't have a voice. Street animals, they need to go to a rescue. They need fosters. They need someone to love. They need someone to give them a second chance. And how interesting is that? All of us need a second chance. Mm. So it's kind of when you have a pet that you're giving a second chance, you could really connect with that, even with that pet, with that cat, that dog, what have you. I think I'll always have a cat or a dog my entire life because I almost need to. I need to. Yeah. It's such a necessity to connect with that. But that's kind of how I see it because, yes, you could get one that's just born. And I'm not saying if people have that, it's wrong. I resonate more with the ones who need that second chance. So it's so cool. It is really cool.
I wonder whether it took your experience to really give you that outlook on life as well.
Yeah.
Maybe that's where I hate to say there's a reason for everything, but I do often think that I went through what I went through so that I can now be the voice of the voiceless, because they don't know how to come out the other side yet. They don't know how to give themselves a second chance in a lot of scenarios. And with adoption, it's very much about I want to be the giver now.
Mm-hmm. Nope.
And not everyone can be that. Everyone's going to be that. But I think from when you've been through ill mental health, maybe you come out the other side more compassionate.
Yeah. Here's the story. When I was doing the 100 days, I saw it as a silo. This is my thing. But then I didn't realize that the more I talked about it, the more other people it would affect in a positive way, Amber. So, for example, a friend, when I was talking about how I felt, he was getting ready to die by suicide. He's fine. He's alive. He's married. He has children. But when I talked about how I felt, he said, "That's exactly how I feel now." And he had a plan and the whole bit. Well, so it went from being a silo to being this thing that's much greater than I will ever be. And it's kind of so that affected him in a positive way. And other people have come to me saying, "Jim, because you talk about it, I was able to realize that I do feel similar." And maybe they weren't suicidal, but they weren't living their best life. And they said, "I needed to talk. I talked to my dad and we had such a good conversation. And now I'm getting therapy, or now I'm going to see my doctor." And other people who've said, because of this, let's see, I had someone reach out to me through Facebook who, because I do promote a lot of all the podcasts I'm on and what have you, and mental health stuff. She even said, I haven't talked to her maybe 3, 4, 5 years, but she reached out to me and said, "My fiance is not doing so well. He is suicidal. It's just the past couple months it happened." So we just opened up a conversation where I asked her some questions and kind of went from there. So it went from being a silo to being the whole farm, if you will. I don't know what else to call it, but it went to be from my thing to our thing to maybe I'm the one person, but I was supposed to go through that to help other people.
Yeah. And you don't feel that at the time. I mean, you never do, because it is an all encompassing, the whole world is centered around you, not through any selfishness of your own or any detriment to anyone's character. It's just that's how the disease takes you, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And you can't see that. But if you can, just open your eyes a little wider, there will be somebody standing right next to you in the shopping queue or at the bus stop who's felt the same, or who's possibly feeling the same at this time.
Yeah.
And it's trying to keep that real, isn't it?
Oh, it is. And I even say now, because now people talk to me about it, Amber, I will tell them, now I'm that other person. I'm not the person who is necessarily going through it, but I'm the person that others are confiding in. So I have a responsibility to, now, for me at least, I see it, again, with great, you know, power comes great responsibility, but overcoming it, it's kind of, I want to help other people. But I try not to tell them, well, you need to do this, because when you're going through depression, that's the last thing in the world I wanted to hear. I would tell the person, look, there's the door. Don't let it hit you in the butt on the way out, because I don't need this right now. I can't take it on right now. I just need someone, you said, who will sit next to me or on the sofa, and we're just going to watch TV, who will just physically be there.
Yeah.
And just let us do whatever. And if I want to talk, or if that person wants to talk to me, I will be glad to listen, and I'll be glad to say, well, have you considered this? Or this is what I did. I mean, is this something you would consider? But I'm never going to try to fix someone, because that's not, in my opinion, what someone wants nor needs. Because, again, when I was going through it, Amber, I probably would have said something I'd regret. I'll be very honest with you, to that person who's trying to be helpful, but they're being the complete opposite of helpful, in my opinion, at least for me at that moment in time. It would have just been, look, I don't need this right now. I just need you to sit there and let me do the talking.
Don't try and fix me.
No. Cause it can't be done overnight. It's not going to happen. And it's a process. It's a process I still am going through 20 years after the fact. It's not something that you overcome. You know, depression is under control, but the anxiety is still there. So I still have to be aware of that. And fortunately, as I said, I'm in a significantly better place. than I was 20 years ago, but it's still something that I deal with, something that I have to deal with.
You deal with on a daily basis.
And yeah.
I find the hardest thing is when you wake up having had a bad dream, or you wake up with a crook in your neck, or and it puts you in a bad mood. And it's that fear of, is this the depression?
Yeah.
Oh my God, is this the depression? There's constant fear. But then I suppose it's just, you manage it, you manage diabetes or arthritis. Mm-hmm. Yes, sometimes it's always there.
Right.
Sometimes it hurts, but you've got to keep doing the exercises. You've got to keep telling the doctor if something's not right. You've got to keep up the medication or whatever you need. Someone will have it and it's out there. You just got to find it. So go ask, you know, go ask for help if that's what you need.
Yeah, and sometimes, especially and when you're really in depression, asking for help can be the toughest thing to do. But I know once I did, it was wow. The fog was cleared out of my head. The fog that had been self-encompassing. Once I talked to the doctor and I admitted I needed help, I saw the world through new eyes, through better eyes, through positive eyes, through wow, life gets better eyes. So seeing it from a different perspective is, I think, so helpful, because people who don't understand now, they hopefully do. And Amber talking about perspective again, I don't know if I would have even done one marathon, let alone 21, if I didn't go through the depression we're talking about. So I don't, there wouldn't be 100 goals, 100 marathon goals. If I would do, I don't think I would even do one. That wasn't part of my plan. And originally, at least not. And then so that's just something that overcoming it really gave me. I want to do something to help myself, but to help other people just because of that. And so those of you who are watching, listening, trust me, it wasn't my plan to run one marathon, but when I overcame depression, oh no, you mess with the wrong person. That's not how it works here. So for me, that's my goal. And it gives me purpose. It gives me purpose every single day. I haven't finished 100. So I need to keep working toward that, regardless if, whatever today holds for, and I'll tell you what, God willing, if I get to 100, then guess what? The goal will be 101. Then it'll be 110. Then it'll be 150. I will keep moving that goal, but there's the original goal.
You might end up Sir Captain Tom Moore, and you've actually, you've got to 100 and you haven't completed your 100th marathon. And it's, well, you're not actually going to be able to run 42K now, but you can do 100 laps of your garden instead.
Yeah,
you can still be saying, and that's what I think he represented, didn't he? He represented that I can't really, but I'm going to anyway, and I'm going to do it this way because it's important that I do it. I mean, how much did he raise?
So I think 30 to 40 million pounds or something that I saw. That's
phenomenal.
Outstanding. And I think he wanted to raise 1,000 pounds or so. Just something to do something better. So, but you could see how I think people want to believe in something that's greater than themselves and believe in a cause. And it went to the National Health Services, I believe, NHS services.
So and other charities related to them. Yeah.
So I think that, so having that, and here's a 99-year-old individual who was a World War II veteran, if I remember correctly.
I believe so.
And he wants to do something to better just the world, to help the UK, to help the people. I think that was, I mean, such a cool thing, such a wonderful thing that he did.
Inspiring, which I think is brilliant. But I think you've shown the same sort of tenacity, I suppose, in doing what you've done.
Thank you.
And I hope you continue to run. And please let us know when you're doing them and how you're getting on, because it's been fantastic to meet you. And I just think
thank you.
Giving people that inspiration is what we're all about. And you've made a huge contribution to that. I believe as well that we are looking at running 100 miles as a community.
Yes. Yeah, Kenny had mentioned that, which is awesome. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how that's going to work yet, but we're raising money for the Tonic Health Men Shed, who are a fraction of Tonic Health that work solely for men. So men, that it's exactly that. It's creating connections. It's giving them a purpose. And I think that raising the money for the men's shed will again provide more equipment for them to do activities and things with, which I think is really important as well, because purpose, it seems to me that Sir Captain Tom Moore, a lot of his inspiration was he needed a purpose during lockdown. Yeah. Otherwise, he could have quite easily just sat there, as I'm sure a lot of people have done, a lot of older people, and died because you're a certain age, whatever. But he's sort of the tenacity of it was, I am going to do this. And we really identified with that, I think, in this country particularly.
No, and I think everyone needs to have a bit of that tenacity with it. I mean, here's a hero, 99 years old, a veteran of World War II, who wants to do 100 laps around his property, if I remember correctly, before he turned 100.
Yeah.
All of us, that's something that you can do at whatever age you're at, and to even just make you feel better. That might be how you're giving back to yourself. Like, and it could be, today I'm going to do one lap. And that's your it's almost an investment in yourself. Yeah. And when I mean one, it could be walking. It doesn't, please, I don't expect anyone else to do 100 marathons. That's just, no, you know, at all. I don't expect anyone to do one, mind you. But at the same time, you could walk around the block, or you could walk around your property, or you could walk into a park and just do a couple laps in the park. Breathe in the fresh air, just relax, enjoy nature, take your dog for a walk, you know, or whatever, or your cat, for those people who take cats for a walk. I mean, I do know.
I mean, that's another breed of people. I'm not sure we need to talk about them.
No, I don't. I've seen a couple of them, but yeah, exactly. You're right. But that's something that you can do that it may not be to raise 30 or 40 million pounds, but it might be just to invest in yourself. And that's another way you could do that and be Sir Captain Thomas Moore for yourself, almost just that same resilience, is looking at him as a guide, and that, well, he did it to help benefit others. And really, when you help benefit yourself and feel better about yourself, then you can help others, and you can help. You could be in a better place to help others. So.
Yeah. So I think we should definitely put it out there now that we want anyone listening to this podcast to hit that recording button and give us, you've got a minute on the recording, and give us our, tell us, what are you going to do? What has this inspired you to do? What are you going to achieve for yourself, to invest in yourself, in your well-being? It might be to improve your mental health. It might be that you don't suffer with any ill mental health and you're listening to this to be educated, I suppose, or to understand a bit more. You might, so raise money, come and raise money for Men's Shed and be part of our 100-mile walk with in honour of Sir Captain Tom Moore. I think I've said that right, haven't I? You've got the sir and the captain around the right way.
Yeah, I think it's the surfer.
We've got a lovely mural's been, it's been graffitied. I'm not sure, it feels a bit wrong to say, oh, it's a lovely piece of art, because it's technically it's illegal, but it is a lovely piece of art in the archways in Spalding, and it's the most beautiful commemorative painting of him, and all done with spray paint and things by local artists. So we'll have to put that up on our Tonic Health, I think, as well. I'm sure that'll be used, because that's a lovely reminder of what he did and how that inspired people. But as have you, and we're so grateful for you sharing your story with us.
And
if we hear from people about what they're going to achieve, what they're going to challenge themselves to. So.
No, thank you. And like I said, the challenge can be whatever you want it to be, really. I mean, and you know, people, I think you people can influence other people more than they believe they can. And it could be going for a walk. And maybe there's somebody out there who needs to go for a walk too, that is going through depression, and you can invite them to go with you. It's the little things that add to a lot, in my opinion.
Absolutely. A bit like my son's coach said to him in hockey this morning. He said, look up. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, that's bigger than just handing the ball to each other because you're closest. And there's somebody out there in the long field waiting. They're waiting. Yeah. They're ready for you. If you just open those eyes and look up.
Exactly. No, I mean, we say the same to our soccer player or football players, whatever, in that I coach. He said, if you're looking at the ground, you only see what's there. If you look up, you'll see who's open. You'll see there's some amazing things you can do with the football, but you have to look up and see who to pass to.
And you have to look up and see where the opportunities are.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you'll
exactly.
just be stuck.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No,
oh, who agree. Knew you coaches are more philosophical than you realized?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Oh, that's fantastic. I think your young ladies are very lucky to have you.
No, thank you.
Coaching them, because you sound like you do a lot in terms of life skills as well as just playing football.
Yeah, we try to. We have fun, though. They have a good time. They're a great group.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you so, so much for your time.
No problem.
It's been
thank you,
really
Amber.
Lovely meeting you. And I hope that people can feel as inspired as I do right now. And not that I'm not lying to you. I'm not going to go and run a marathon. I don't feel getting on the treadmill. But I do feel setting myself a goal, because just like you said, you're going to be a long way off of hitting those 100 marathons. So you're always going to have something to work on. You've always got that to work on. And I think that's a real positive. And even if you are suffering with ill mental health, if you can give yourself a goal, even if it's just a little one to the end of the week, that's what you need, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Even a day-to-day goal. Even my pastor, who he's unfortunately passed away, but when I told him he was going through depression, he said, Jim, I want you to write down three things that you're going to accomplish today. And one of them can be get out of bed, one could be go to the bathroom, and one could be to make coffee. And trust me, getting out of bed was my biggest goal for a while. But but once I did those three things, I felt accomplished. I did three things today. Yes. Now today that wouldn't be as much of a big accomplishment for me, but trust me, at that moment in time, just getting out of bed would be running a marathon for me now.
Yeah.
So I can, so that was, that's just some advice I guess I could give to anyone who's going through it. Write down three things, and the basic thing could be just put 2 feet on the ground. You have to go to the bath. It's going to happen. Nature's going to call. I mean, I drink about 5 or 6 cups of coffee every day. So,
I'm like that with cans of Pepsi Max. Unfortunately, the same level of caffeine going through your blood.
Yeah.
All day.
So comparable. Yeah. So it's going to happen. So those are two things that are going to happen. So really, it's just. But once you get out of bed, that's when things can happen. Mm. That's the thing. So staying in bed, nothing can really happen. But once you get out of bed, make your bed. And then that way you kind of close that chapter on yesterday, and now we're opening today's chapter. And really, it could just be a day-to-day thing, or it could be hour-to-hour. But before you write it down, all the things you've done, and you're like, wow, I accomplished a lot today. And then confident, you feel better.
And I think it's really important that people listening to this are listening to this with an open mind if they've never been in that situation, because it probably sounds pathetic if you've
never been in that position. Yeah.
But I want to beg people to think beyond, open your mind and just trust that there are 27 to 28% of people know what we're talking about. We're not making it up.
No.
This is a genuine feeling. And that would be a genuine achievement to get out of bed.
Just get out of bed. And I mean, take it from someone who, and not to brag, but who's gone from that as my biggest accomplishment to having done 4 marathons in 4 months. So that's not, there's two opposite ends of the spectrum. That's one is I can't get out of bed. And the next one, it's all right, let's do 42 kilometers today. So it's not, I can't compare it to much else, but really. And if you think of it, 28%, if there's 4 people in general in a nuclear family, there's a chance every person's family will be affected at some point in time. And, or more. I look at my classes and if we have 16 or 20. Well, that means maybe 4 or 5 students will have some sort of mental health challenges. And it's important to.
And to be fair as well, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and to think that they're just the people that have come forward to become part of that statistic. I still think there's another 25% of people who never access the help. Well, let's face it, there are a lot of people that do take their own lives every day who maybe haven't even acknowledged that they've needed help. So we can only hope that this sort of thing, what we do, this is what I hope, this sort of thing and what we're doing today and what you've been able to be part of with us, which is fantastic. Does help.
Yeah. It's just important to eradicate the stigma so people realize that this is just as real as asthma. It's as real as epilepsy. I have a seizure condition. I haven't had one in a long time, but I do take medicine for that. It's as real as cancers. It's real as diabetes. It's as real as a broken bone. It's not something that people are just faking. And in fact, from what I recall now, there's actually tests that will measure the serotonin level in the brain. From what I recall seeing not that long ago, that can kind of show you physically, this is what a person who's not depressed, what their brain looks serotonin wise. And this is a person who does. All so right. People who are saying, well, oh, it's not real. No, there's actually science now that is proving that this is what one looks. And this is what a person who is not going through it looks. And this is what the brain of one who is. So the science is now being there, you know?
Yeah. The science being there, I think, can make a lot of people that are more black and white thinkers. And if it hurts or it's swollen, then there's something wrong with it. Therefore, we can go to a doctor. If it's not, then how do we know there's anything actually wrong? I think that is really important. And that could be a massive part of recovery as well.
Sure.
Being able to show that science.
And just showing your support system or potential support system. Because you said, Amber, certain people are going to say, not real. No, it's you know, it's all in your head. As well, no, of course it is in my head. Where else is it supposed to be? You know, but at the same time, who don't believe it? But here's the science that is definitely showing you this is what one looks, this is what the other looks. And if anything, that will hopefully help people who are, you said, more black and white to realize that this is the proof. This is the proof that
this is the physical evidence for a mental condition that is very hard to read.
And the thing is, if you're going through clinical depression, you are. You don't, it's not something that but as an individual, I knew I was going through something, but at the same time, to show it to someone who isn't, it can be a challenge, you know.
And we've also talked about emotional intelligence. So you were obviously more aware than a lot of other people are when they suffer with it, poor mental health. But that's what we hope. That we'll leave that for another podcast, I think. The how do we become more emotionally intelligent? I've just found that book, actually. I thought I'd mention it before I let you go. The book is called I Had a Black Dog. His Name Was Depression by Matthew Johnstone. And it's in print, I think, on Amazon and all other. There are very many other booksellers out there. But I think that is a really good start for people if you want to understand depression or if you want to share it with somebody.
Yeah,
take a look.
Thank you. I'm probably gonna buy it just so I have it, because then it's a reference point for someone else.
I was just gonna say exactly the same. I think there should definitely be the two books, the accompanying book for those who live with somebody or who support somebody with the black dog, to have those in a centre somewhere, Tonic Health and Tonic 44. They have a cafe that I was at this morning in a little village just down the road from Spalding, so out of the main town. But to have those, they've got loads of books there. They've got puzzles, it's just a lovely area. I mean, obviously it's not working at the moment, it's not running properly at the moment because of COVID, but to have those books present in any sort of environment that people can just glance at it, because it is literally, it's just a comic book, there's no great reading in it, it's all shown through the graphics. So it's a really good book, it really is. So
that's cool.
Well, thank you so much. I've taken an hour and 45 minutes of your time.
You're totally fine. I had mentioned to Kenny, I said, I don't have anything else set today. I have plenty of time. So we had, and really, as you're aware, Amber, the message needs to be set and the message needs to be told. So no matter how long it takes to tell the message, I think it's important. So I appreciate your time as well, you know, as the host too, you know.
Not at all. Well, I hope you got to get across what you felt you wanted to share with us. I'm so quite aware that I don't want to leave people just endlessly talking, but I also don't want to interrupt because obviously there's things you want to share being on this podcast. But I hope you got to, you know, share everything you wanted to with me.
No, I did. And I said, if anyone has questions, we'll set up the Q&A at some point in time for people who have that. And if they can't make it, Kenny has my information. People are more than welcome to contact me. Again, I can't.
That might be really good if we could put your email, perhaps.
My social media, I can send along as well. Then, but that way, it's just so people realize it's not, okay, he's here and now he's gone. It's no, pardon me. If anything, we're talking about having that one person who cares. Well, hey, I was there once. I can be that one person who I am that one person who cares. So don't think that no one does, because I can't tell you how many people have come to me with their particular story, regardless if it was them that it affected themselves or a loved one. So I have been there. So I totally can respect that and understand having that one person who you need to confide in. And again, I'm not going to fix anyone. I'm not going to diagnose anybody. I can just tell them if they want to ask questions, I can tell you, this is how I felt, because I've done that a lot. I can't tell you how many times, but I've done that a lot for a number of people.
I think you're Kenny's new best friend, definitely. He's going through some stuff at the moment, bless his heart. And I think he feels he's found a soulmate in you. He can't be complimentary enough about you, but it was really nice to meet you myself as well.
No, thank you. I appreciate it. It's funny because I even told some of my friends, I said, I think I found my British BFF. I said, my gosh, Kenny and I were talking about wrestling, WWF. We're talking about football. Yeah, he's an Arsenal supporter. I mean, I'm an Aston Villa supporter. I won't bore you with the whole story, but I did meet the team 20 years ago when they came to the States, and I didn't have a Premier League team. And so I've been crying, and in good ways and bad ways, and riding the roller coaster that is being an Aston Villa supporter ever since. So I'll put it that way. But they're mentioned in my dissertation and the acknowledgements because of surviving the drop last year, just because of how they played at the tail end of the season. That's how much that meant to me. And I don't have anyone I can really talk to that degree about English football. So it's great to have people to connect with, and yourself as well. So
that's brilliant.
Yeah, without a doubt. But I've been telling, and they said, it's about time, because of that. They don't, I have friends who are football fans as far as English, Premier League fans, but I tell them about Emiliano Martinez, who they purchased from Arsenal, and this person, and they just look at me.
I'm looking at you now.
That's great, Jim. That's great. Ollie Watkins just has a great season. Grealish, when he's out, they can't play that way. And they're, the kind of the way that the dog looks at you when they don't understand what you want, they kind of look at you. That's how my friends kind of look at me. They're all right. That's awesome, Jim. I told you that when Grealish is out, they can't play. That's awesome. They have no idea what I'm talking about. So
that's what happens mostly when I talk to the other mums at the school. They just glaze over.
No.
I found my friends that do to talk politics and education reform. And
sure.
I found those people too.
Right. No, I totally get, yeah. No, and there are people that out there. That's the cool thing. So, but I might as well show you why I have you on. So I did show you that I have my
you did, but it doesn't mean a lot to me, I must confess.
The listeners, but who knows, some of the listeners or the watchers might be, oh gosh, forget this guy. But still, but I'm not a glory hunter, put it that way. I being a Villa supporter,
you're a loyal fan.
I've been loyal and I'm a Philadelphia fan in sports here, so trust me, when you're a Philadelphia fan, you're a glutton for punishment. But I've been a loyal fan in all the sports in Philadelphia since a child. That's just how I am. I've always been that way. I'll always be that way.
I'm a musician. We don't tend to touch sport if we can help it.
No, I cannot. But music therapy, that's another. Oh my God. That's something else for
Mondays about music.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, music can influence you so much. And I know just myself, it depends on the mood I'm in, going from classical music, Beethoven, to classical music, Led Zeppelin. It depends on what mood. But just how it can,
my mum always used to say to me, I can tell what sort of day you've had at school. This is obviously when I was a kid and I was living at home. She said, by what you started playing on the piano when you came home.
There you go.
She could tell exactly what sort of day you'd had. And that was without even realizing I was connecting to music on that level,
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
No, I can understand.
Well, Well, I better let you go.
No, and I'm sorry to take up so much time, but it was great to talk. And please keep in touch if I can ever help. So we'll do the Q&A, so we already know that. You know.
Yeah, we will. So, I don't know how quickly they'll be able to set that up, but obviously it's another load on Kenny.
No.
All right, then. Well, lovely meeting you. Thank you again.
Thank you, Amber. I appreciate your time, and have a great rest of your, afternoon.
Well, yes, afternoon, evening. Well, you have a fabulous day, though.
Thank you, Amber.
So that was an epic chat I've just had with the wonderful Jim Schubach. He's a real inspiration, a real positive character. And he has said that if anyone wants to get in touch, we have the details of his social media pages. Please do get in touch with him. He might be that one person that you need to talk to. And he's there for you if that's the case. I have a little random act of kindness story for you again this week, called Letters from Uncle Louie. It says, the pandemic and 2020 left a lot of us struggling with fear, loneliness, worry. I found myself in July suffering from newfound health anxiety. I remembered, when I help others, I'm healed in return. How could I help others when volunteering is not allowed? I came up with an idea: to write letters to nursing homes to make seniors smile. It's simple yet profound. I remembered an elderly couple I visited as a child and named the group Letters from Uncle Louie after the elderly man I once had called Uncle Louie. What happened next changed everything. People from across the globe signed up to write to seniors without expecting anything in return. We currently write to 10 homes in the USA and the UK. A few friends, old and new, helped us grow and run the group. The members of the group, the directors of the homes, all leave me speechless with their unconditional kindness. One person can come up with an idea, but it takes a team to make it come to reality. I'm humbled and in awe of their kindness and always inspired to do more. So that's me for another week. I hope you've enjoyed listening. And if you have any of your own stories of random acts of kindness or anything you want to share with us, please use the voice recorder button at the bottom of the podcasts. So that's us for another week. If you want to get in touch with us, please check out our social media pages. We are Tonic Talk Podcast. We are part of the Tonic Health Group, so you can find us on all major platforms. Thank you for another week for listening.